Well, greetings and welcome to The Dividing Line. A tired host with you today. 8.5 hours of driving time through. Let's just put it this way. I now know why they set off all the nuclear weapons in Nevada. There's nothing here. it's just all there is to it. That driving down the middle of the state thing. Yeah. Anyway, so we're here, despite, some great construction, narrow lanes, 40 to 50 mile an hour crosswinds as I was getting into Vegas. That's always fun when you're pulling a 30 foot wall behind you. That was the first time I felt a little, again, it handled it fine. So we're here in one piece. But as I said, might be a little slower today than normal. I do want to start off extending my condolences to my good friend Chris Arnzen. Chris's brother John passed away today. Somehow, I had just actually disconnected from Rich because this cellular coverage in Nevada, maybe it's complete, but I think the mutants from all the atomic explosions suck up the signal or something, but you'd have a cell for a while and then boop, and it was gone. And so I had just hung up from Rich, not hung up, had been disconnected. And Chris somehow got through out in the middle of absolutely nowhere and told me that his brother had passed away just today. And, so we extend our condolences. Chris had, asked us all to be praying for his brother and opportunities of witness to his brother, and he testifies that that witness was fruitful, which is a wonderful thing. And so, anyways, we extend our condolences to Brother Chris in the loss of his brother at this time. Lots of things to get to. I did my first entertaining in the mobile command center last night. I got it all cleaned up. Well, as clean up as I can. I actually saw a mobile RV, power cleaning thing. By the way, Rich, if someone pulls into the slot next to me during the program, we're going to need an extended commercial break. Because I have a feeling I will have to inch my truck over a little bit to help them out. So queue something up. Get some, I don't know if you have it, you probably have it at home to queue up. So get out a harmonica. Sing some, I'm sure you have some French music somewhere. You can talk about, you know, cooking croissants and things like that. But I seriously, if I see somebody coming in, I'm going to go, all right, we're going to take a technical break, and we'll be right back, and I will need to throw a pair of shoes on and probably move my truck. So, hey, this is live, folks. There are some folks that might think that this is as fake as the moon landings, which weren't fake. But it's live, it's real, and I mean, the place is wide open, so I'm hoping they don't stick somebody right in the spot next to me, but you know how that is. You know, everybody on a plane, and the seat, plane's wide open, and they put the football player in the middle seat next to you. That's just how that used to work. I probably will never know how that works anymore. But anyway, what was I saying? Oh, so I actually had 10 people. Now, they all couldn't sit down. But we did have 10 folks, in here, and it cleans up nicely when I get the bikes out and stuff like that. So one of those people was the guy behind me, him. Well, that would actually make 11. Some of you are wondering what in the world Ultraman is doing in the background, but, I am now the proud owner of an Ultraman, doll. Oh, I didn't notice that his suit is held on by Velcro. I'm not sure what happens when you go supersonic. Anyway, I saw Ultraman when I was a kid. It's a Japanese thing, I think. Anyway, but this is Chris's way of saying if I'm going to send him Buddy Dolls, because he's never watched Elf and swears he never will, but we'll get to him eventually. But I've seen Ultraman, and I am very certain that Buddy is significantly more funny than Ultraman is. His English is better. In that one scene in the movie where Buddy does the rapid fire snowball thing, can't do that. So yeah, but thank you, Chris. We'll put Ultraman over here because that might freak out a lot of people in the audience if it was there for a lengthy period of time. All right, serious stuff. Yesterday, may have hit the day before, but for me, it was yesterday. I sort of catch up on things late. I would like to suggest to you that there is a direct connection between the utter humiliation of the United States that is taking place at the hands of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and the resultant inevitable explosion of Islamic terrorism around the world that will result from all that. There is a direct connection between the humiliation this nation is experiencing in Afghanistan right now and the headlines a couple of days ago, yesterday or day before, depending on when you saw it, that says that Pete Buttigieg, and the headlines say, and his husband. I will not utilize that language. I'm just repeating what the headline said. It is a fundamental abuse of the language, of the categories. It is an affront to me as a husband of 39 years to my wife. And that's all I can have in the marriage relationship is a wife. I am a husband. A husband cannot have a husband. That is a contradiction in terms. It is a perversity, an utter perversion of the created order. And so the announcement that Pete Buttigieg and his significant other are becoming parents, there's a direct connection between those two things. Because any nation that can have an individual who clearly has intentions to run for the highest office in the land again in the future, who clearly traded his last run, and that's his last run was I'm young, I want to get into the next regime, probably knew they were going to win at that point in time, the fix was in. And then when it came down to, okay, here's our plan. Y'all are beating up on Biden. We want a figurehead. We want a shadow government, and we want a figurehead, somebody who will look like a harmless old grandpa who couldn't hurt a flea because he couldn't find the flea. And that's what they got. And so here, this man who's going to be probably running for higher office or positioning himself to be placed in higher office, I said in 2020, I said, this is our last shot at a free election. And I was wrong. We were already too late. I was way ahead of that curve. But anyway, this man and his homosexual partner cannot be parents. And to identify them as such is to massively degrade fatherhood motherhood, marriage, parenthood, and in this case, adoption. Adoption's a beautiful thing, but adoption is adoption into an actual family made up of father and mother, or at least one or the other, in those rare occasions when that is what takes place. But how are they connected? They're both meant to humiliate the nation. They are judgments. They're only 10 years ago, no one could have ever imagined that Kabul would fall to the Taliban with people clinging to C-17s and falling out of the air. Worse than, far worse than Saigon ever was. And at the same time, a Senate-approved, quote-unquote, married homosexual would claim to be becoming a parent via adoption. Only 10 years ago. And things were bad 10 years ago. 20 years ago, you would have been laughed to scorn if you had said such a thing was going to take place. And here we are. And it is a part of the continuing, and it will get worse and worse, humiliation of a nation. And here we all are. Most of the listeners, not all, but most of the listeners of this program are in the United States. We have listeners all over the globe. We're thankful for all of them. And those that are all over the globe know how important to the stability of the globe for the past 25 years this nation has been. We are going to be absolutely humiliated before our enemies. And we need to be clear and open in telling the world why it is. Think about it. If you want to be accurate about this, and if you want to be used in the long term, when you think about the prophets of Israel, what did they do before judgment fell? They called for repentance. Repentance from what? They named the sins for which God's wrath was building up upon them. So that when his wrath broke forth, there wasn't any confusion as to why it was breaking forth. And that's the situation here. Now, the prophets were not loved for being prophets. The vast majority of prophets were disliked. by the way, my phone, which is acting as my connection right now, my phone has been going absolutely bonkers. Phoenix, I have not been rained on since I left New Mexico in this entire trip. But my house, my son sent me some pictures of my backyard. Wow. So much for the top of the gazebo that I put on right before I left. Lightning and rain, and it's just been crazy the whole time I've been gone, and my phone is telling me there was lightning in the backyard. Yeah, that's great. All right, wonderful. Anyway, the prophets were not loved for the message they brought. Remember Jeremiah? Rich remembers Jeremiah because back when Rich first started volunteering with Alpha and Omega Ministries many, many, many years ago, we had a special nickname for him. And part of the background of it was when they threw Jeremiah into the slimy pit. And they didn't appreciate the ministry of the prophets in warning them concerning what was coming. And our society clearly does not like the fact that we will be warning them. But we have to, so that when wrath falls, it is our duty to let the culture know this is what brought the wrath of God. This is what brought these things to bear. And obviously, if we are not repenting of similar sins in our own lives, then it's going to be empty words. But we must be faithful and speak the truth concerning what is bringing this judgment upon our nation. And so the disaster in Afghanistan, the fact that our enemies know that we are no longer a threat to them. We may still have all the ships and the planes, but our enemies have successfully emasculated our forces. They have. You look at Milley, you look at the promotion. The United States government was spending the greatest part of its effort in Afghanistan to promote sexual immorality. The Afghans know that. They know that. And the sad thing is, for a lot of Muslims, Christianity and America are the same thing. And if anything proves that's not true, that should, but anyway. So, there you go. I hate to have to even mention these things, but we need to be straight up front about it. In a related subject, one of the great tragedies of the lengths to which the left has been willing to go to destroy our liberties and freedoms and to enslave the population of the world, especially in formerly free places like Australia and New Zealand and Canada, where especially in Australia and New Zealand, it's just like people just rolled over and stuck their feet up in the air and wiggled a few times and said, please pat my belly. It's just astonishing what the Australians are doing, the absolute Nazi-esque powers they're giving the police. Liberty and freedom gone. And I don't see anybody pushing back. It's like, okay, you know, whatever, all right. Maybe it's that mateship thing, you know. Well, my mate would never, yes, your mate will. Oh, yes, your mate will. And your mate has. Anyway, in the midst of all this stuff, who can trust anything that is said by governing authorities any longer? We've been lied to over and over and over and over again. It's astonishing. So who can trust anything anymore? Who can trust what numbers are being reported? I mean, they literally changed how you fill out death certificates in March of 2020. Huh, wonder why. Wonder what they were expecting. Oh, so that the numbers would be inflated. So you dying with COVID or dying of COVID became the same thing, which wasn't the case in 2019 or 2018 or 2017 or anything. So you wouldn't have any way of comparing numbers, real numbers, to actually see. But, you know, we've been through worse than this in the past, and we didn't destroy ourselves. Oh, no, no, no. You've got to convince everybody this is the bubonic plague. Three-quarters of everyone's going to die. And so you must submit because that's what this is. Who can trust numbers anymore? Who can trust anyone's numbers? The FDA will undoubtedly approve the new vaccines, and they will do so without any of the safety data that would have been demanded for every single vaccine up to 2020. And that will prove very clearly what this is all about. It has nothing to do with public health, public safety. It has everything to do with power and a very, 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 very corrupt regime. So they will approve it. And as a result, there will be more and more mandates. Fauci wants this. I mean, that man just reminds me, Mengele, Fauci, I don't, you know, same difference. Long term. Same worldview, seems. And, the mandates will just become more and more and more, and there will be in the pre 2020 world, there would have been all sorts of room for discussion of, well, I'll give an example. Remember back when people were laughing about the idea of wearing masks and they were the people in charge, Fauci and others? And then all of a sudden that changed. And at first you had, except for people who have medical reasons not to do so, because there are lots of said medical reasons. You notice there aren't any medical reasons anymore. No one cares. Absolutely no one cares. I'm in Nevada right now, poor me. And it's Democratic state. So they're all masked up again. And if putting on a mask endangers your life, nobody cares. And I'm not just talking about bacteriological infections and things like that. I'm talking about there are certain medical conditions where hindering airflow and blocking the airways can cause cardiac issues and respiratory issues and blood pressure issues and all sorts of things. There are people who should never wear masks, and nobody cares. Because it's not about public safety. It's not about your health. And if you die, the regime doesn't care. That happened awful fast, didn't it? It's all happened awful fast. And that's why there's no options being given whatsoever for these mandates. You cannot sit down and have a rational conversation about safety protocols. You know, I had an interaction with a guy on Twitter, and he was just blasting away at me for being this, that, and the other thing. And I pointed out to him, and I've mentioned this on program before, I had a cardiac procedure 10 years ago now. And though I'm very, very healthy and intend on doing a, Lord willing, it's one reason I'm getting to bed early tonight, very, very difficult bike ride in the morning outdoors. If you think about Las Vegas, there's only one place I'm going tomorrow. But despite all that, people are normally surprised to discover that I'm a cardiac patient. I take a medication in light of that procedure 10 years ago. And it's what allows me to do that kind of stuff. There is that much, see that? That much safety data concerning the interaction of mRNA genetic vaccines, which clearly have already been admitted by everybody, have killed people by inflaming their what? It ain't their left big toe. It's especially with men, younger men, but heart issues. Oh! And so if I go to a cardiologist and say, so, what are the 5-year safety? Because this spike protein thing, it stays in the body. I was told by scientific geniuses that the spike protein just disappears shortly after the injection. You know, it does what it does and it's gone. No. All the studies are saying, nope. It's been found in the brain. It's been found in the heart. It's been found in the gonads. There are tremendous indications of that no pregnant woman should ever walk past a vaccination place, let alone get vaccine. But of course, don't want to talk about any of that. Nope, can't even have that conversation. There's only one narrative. Anything else is misinformation. It's Pravda all over the place. But there is no 5-year safety data as to the interaction of the COVID vaccines with someone who's had a procedure like I have, let alone with the drug I take. None, zero, nada. Do they care? Nope. What does that tell you? It tells you what the real motives are. They don't want you to have options. It's submit or die. And that's very, very much in the line of how a certain movement acts. And that movement is, of course, the left. And should that surprise anybody? Those are the people who killed 120 million people last century. And we've forgotten all about it and don't care about it. We can't even figure out what 120 million would look like. That's more than the population of most nations in Europe and places like that. So they are, their goal is full, total submission. And hey, if it happens to work out that the people that don't want to submit just sort of like die in the process, all the better for us, right? So if there's still at least 100 million people in the United States that haven't submitted to this yet, my hope is, as Doug Wilson said on the last blog, there might be a blog, maybe a blog came out today, I haven't looked. Yeah, it's Wednesday, isn't it? Yeah, it probably is. Let's try to stand firm, because they're going to have a hard time putting a third of America in the gulags. And we've got to push back. Got to stand firm. Okay, so there's some of that type of stuff. And yes, I know I see the camera moving every time I touch the mouse, but that's just sort of how things are. The sun's coming through the window. I put the awning out a little bit, but the wind's really blowing. And I don't want to put it out too much because that can flap around and get torn and all sorts of weird stuff like that. So the sun's just getting down to where my beard is looking almost angelically white with the extra light there. So I guess we can live with that. Okay. Let's get back to by the way, and I was going to say, you know, when people come to me and say, you know, you've got to do this, this is how we show love and things like that. At the suggestion of my brother, Jeff Durbin, who got one of these for his sermon notes, and is really good for taking notes during debates, stuff like that, I came up with a very complex response to those who will demand that I do that, and so I thought I'd share it with you. Yeah, there you go. This is high tech. This is a high tech device, and that's a high tech device, and this is a high tech device. But this is using low tech reasoning on high tech devices. No, not gonna do that. Oh, then he says as it falls apart in his hand. Okay, all right. That was just the cover. Don't worry. I did break anything. Very sensitive. Yes. I just said I didn't break it. Rich just said, don't break it, which is also what he said before I took off in this thing. And which is why I've been, my blood pressure has been 47 points over normal. Thanks to him. French people. Anyway, no. I only have one leg left, and it's a leg I know real well. And so I've got one leg left to get back to Phoenix. And when I park this thing in front of my house, and it's all in one piece, and there's nothing broken, there's no accidents, and there's nothing hanging off the side, things like that, I'm going to take a picture, and I'm going to send it to Rich. And I'm just not going to make any comments. I'm just going to go. Okay, so I'm going to do. But I still have one leg to go, so disaster could strike. By the way, I have two of these, and they have been awesome. These insulated doohickey whoppers, you know, the metal thingies where the ice just stays in all day long and it's ice cold. When you're on the road, just, mine's a Zojirushi. Zojirushi. It probably means something pagan. I don't know. all I can tell you is they really work. And they're really good. All right. So, we have covered... Y'all seen this? Of course y'all have seen it. You seen it up close? Let me show that to you. It's a... forgot the guy's name. I got it in Santa Fe. And it's a special pottery process that's fired at ridiculously high temperatures. And it's really pretty. Now, don't worry. One of my first duties when I'm prepping to pull out is it comes off the wall. I'm in the back here, and I know where the major movement takes place in a unit like this, and it's right here. This gets the most swing, the most bounce, the whole nine yards. You don't leave anything back here that you don't want going bouncing all over the place, because that's how it works. Okay. We mentioned last time, in light of what has happened in Afghanistan, that I think some of our attention may be returned to the area of Islam. Certainly, conversations we have had in the past in regards to the nature of the Salafi movement, Wahhabism, the ultra-fundamentalist forms of Islam seen in the Taliban. It's unfortunately very easy for a lot of Christians to just not return the favor to Muslims that we demand for ourselves. We want to be differentiated from Roman Catholicism, from Eastern Orthodoxy, because we have fundamentally different beliefs, especially in regards to the doctrine of salvation. And so when a Muslim points to what they're seeing in veneration of icons, worship of statues, latria dulia, things along those lines, we want to be able to say, well, we believe in sola scriptura, and I'm fully aware the Eastern Orthodox have a very thought through defense on that issue, because they, a lot of their theology developed in light of the presence of Islam after the 7th century. I do know that. I'm just making another point here, and that is that we ask for the ability to differentiate, to lay out foundational differences, and so we need to do the same if we're going to be consistent. If you're not going to be consistent, then, you know, can't really have a meaningful conversation with you. But still, my concern is that there may be a hesitation on the part of many people to lovingly, graciously engage with Muslim people because of a anticipated upswing in Islamic violence. You can already go on YouTube and see unbelievably horrid things from the Taliban and from Boko Haram. There is a real strong Christian position to be presented, and it's not an egalitarian position. It's a complementarian position, even though I don't like that term. It's a patriarchal position, for that matter. If you understand that biblical patriarchy is something that is beautiful to biblical womanhood, then you miss the whole thing, and you've been listening to certain people on the left of Big Eva way too much. So anyway, the point is accurately representing where people are coming from, very, very important. I'm concerned there's going to be hesitation to engage Muslims, but I'm going to try to encourage us. And one of the ways to encourage us is to have a knowledge of what the Quran says, and specifically what it says to us. So think about it this way. If this all started because I want to go through Surah 4 and Surah 5 in response to Jake and others, video. I haven't listened to it yet, like I said. I have it, but I haven't done so yet. Where he tries to argue that the Quran does not misrepresent the doctrine of the Trinity. Okay, I've done a few debates on that. I have a feeling I know where it's going to go, but what I want to do is I want to say, okay, look, let's see how accurately you can handle our scriptures and we can handle yours. And the fact of the matter is, I just don't see a lot of Muslims that have a high standard of doing meaningful, contextual, historical exegesis of the text of the Quran. Part of the reason for that is because of how they view the text of the Quran. If you believe the text of the Quran was written on a heavenly tablet in eternity past, it had, and it was never created, it is itself eternal, that changes everything about how you would try to interpret it. But the reality is, everything you know about the Quran came to you in history. It came to you from a period of time 600 years after the time of Christ, and therefore there is a context there that needs to be dealt with. And I just don't see most, especially Muslim apologists, engaging that. And that kind of, the tafsir is Islamic commentary. Tafsir literature is frequently more like reading the Mishnah, Jewish traditional interpretations, than it is doing any type of meaningful exegesis. So and here's what I was going to say. You want a cool way to start a conversation? Or something to use in a conversation, not in a gotcha moment, but in a extend this, open up more doors context. And I've done this a number of times and it's very successful. If you take the time to find out what the Quran says to you, and you say to the Muslim, well, you know, while I don't believe that the Quran is a revelation from God, I do have enough respect for the Islamic people to have taken a look at what the Quran specifically says to me and my people, so I know what its concerns are. And when I did, what I discovered is that the author of the Quran doesn't seem to understand what I believe in the first place. And so either the Quran doesn't address what I believe, and there are some Muslims that will go, yeah, it probably doesn't. But most Muslims believe, oh, yes, it does. It is specifically addressing what you believe. And that opens up all sorts of possibilities of conversation. And so I think it is important to be able to say yes. For example, if you're not going to read the entirety of the Quran, and some people won't, some people just aren't comfortable doing that. I mean, if you're going to be witnessing to Muslims, you need to. It's not very long. It's sort of like reading the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, Full Great Price for witnessing the Mormons. I mean, that's just an unnecessary speed bump in the way. You know, well, have you ever read the Book of Mormon? Yeah, multiple times. Then the Doctrine comes for a great price, the teachings of Prophet Joseph Smith, the marvelous work of wonder, and opens up the door. But even if you're not going to read all the Quran, at least if you work through the sections, honestly, that specifically address the Alal Kitab, the people of the book, and the Alal Injil, the people of the gospel, you can say, I haven't read all the Quran, but I have read what it says to me. And here's what I think about that. And that's a door opener. That is a door opener. And most Muslims will respect you for disagreeing as long as you at least took the time to think about it, read it, try to accurately represent them. Not all, but vast majority will do so. So with that in mind, last time I showed you my Quran. That's the program, my Quran. By the way, Silly Brit wrote to me, texted me after the program, and said that Alim's the scholar, program that I had used for years has become, as so many have, cloud-based, web-based, it's online, and I suppose it's a subscription thing now. And I didn't look it up, didn't have a chance to look it up. I've been driving too much. And I generally do not do web searches while driving on two-lane roads with semis passing going the other direction. And so I haven't looked it up, but I appreciate that information, and I will see if it's but because this one really does have everything in it. It has tafsir, it has different translations, and the biggest thing is the ability to look up Arabic roots and find all the places they're used in the Quran. That's far better than, for example, a exhaustive concordance based upon a translation. So it's just really good and very, very useful. And so I had also mentioned that this one has the Sahih International translation in it, which it really sort of is my favorite. Just as far as generally, it seems to be, I think it does a good job. And so we are looking at Surah 4, and the reason we're looking at Surah 4 is because it contains the prohibition of saying 3. So remember last time, I'll read it again. Oh, people, well, let me just read this whole section, okay? So you've got the idea of what we're going to be looking at, why it's important. Oh, people of the scripture, or people of the book, al-kitab, do not commit excess in your religion or say about Allah except the truth. The Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, was but a messenger of Allah, and his word which he directed to Mary, and a soul, bracket, created at a command, bracket, from him. There is no created at a command in the Arabic. That's a commentary, and there's a lot of commentary, a lot of translations. So believe in the law of his messengers, and do not say 3. The Yusuf Ali translation says Trinity. The Quran never uses the technical word for Trinity. It says 3. Do not say 3. Desist. It is better for you. Indeed, Allah is but one God. Said over and over again. If you say, do not say 3, there is only one God, then what you're saying is, do not say 3 gods. There isn't any question about that. Exalted is he above having a son. What did the author of the Quran understand as sonship? What did the author of the Quran understand Christians to believe about that? Important issues. Exalted is he above having a son. To him belongs whatever is in the heavens and whatever is on the earth. And sufficient is Allah as disposer of affairs. Never would the Messiah disdain to be a servant of Allah. So what's lying behind that? We have to ask the question. What is the author of the Quran attempting to argue, or what is he arguing against? And is it an accurate understanding? Never would the Messiah disdain to be a servant of Allah. Is there any Christian who would deny that the term servant, especially in the form pais, used in Acts, but that Jesus served the Father here on earth? Because it says Messiah. Now, let me just throw this out here. I see no evidence, and I would challenge my Muslim friends. Show me evidence that the author of the Quran understood the concept of messiahship. I see absolutely no evidence whatsoever that he did. I think I've thrown out before that that would be a really good topic for debate. And whoever disdains his worship and is arrogant, he will gather them to himself altogether. So, disdains his worship is, I'm sorry, that's about Allah. I misread that. Never would the Messiah disdain to be a servant of Allah, nor would the angels near to him. And whoever disdains his worship and is arrogant, he will gather them to himself altogether. So that's talking about the worship of Allah, not Jesus, just in case you're confused by that. As for those who believe and did righteous deeds, he will give them in full their rewards and grant them extra from his bounty. But as for those who disdained and were arrogant, he will punish them with a painful punishment, and they will not find for themselves, besides Allah, any protector or helper. O mankind, There has come to you a conclusive proof from your Lord, and we have sent down to you a clear light. So those who believe in the law and hold fast to him, he will admit them to mercy from himself and bounty and guide them to himself in a straight path, et cetera, et cetera. So here it, at least we read it in context. And the key issue, of course, is the 171st ayah. Ayah is what we would call a verse. Ayat is the plural, so verses. And a surah is a chapter slash book. Depends on how you want to define that. The second surah is as long as the book, but like the 114th surah is a matter of words. So anyway. So when we look at Surah 4171, we know that the audience, so when we interpret any ancient work, if we interpret a passage from the Psalter, here's a good example, because it's going to be something I'm going to be doing further soon. Lord willing, I could forget. I'm going to be hit with a bunch of stuff when I get back trying to catch up with stuff. So if need be, remind me. But Psalm 12. I started listening to a debate that took place recently between a fellow who grew up in an IFB church and has moved out of that and is no longer King James only versus just a standard fire-breathing King James only guy. I didn't get much of it listened to because I forgot while having stable internet to download the entire file to my phone. So I was listening via the web in the truck. And like I said, I was driving through the nuclear wastelands of Nevada. So that got all messed up. But I heard enough that I know that this King James only guy is just throwing out wildly inaccurate stuff that just from a historical perspective, you're like, what? Not even close. But he's connecting it all together and doing all this kind of stuff. And then one of the texts that he quotes is Psalm 12. And King James only advocates believe that Psalm 12 all of a sudden leaves talking about God delivering the poor and the needy, the righteous are being persecuted. All of a sudden, leaves that subject and all of a sudden has a prophetic word about the divine preservation of the King James Version of the Bible in English, which didn't exist yet as language. And one of the key elements in responding to that abuse of Psalm 12 is to establish to whom the psalm is being addressed, and hence that allows you to create a consistent reading across the entirety of the psalm, which then, when there is any ambiguity, so there's allegedly, we'll talk about this, but an ambiguity, you will preserve him, you'll preserve them. What is God promising to preserve? The King James only guy says it's the words of the King James Version of the Bible. The less radical Ruckmanites of them would say it's a promise that God will preserve the words of Scripture. They knowing that connecting that to the King James is sheer insanity. But anyway, a more contextual reading is following the context and the audience that's being addressed, it's those that God has promised to deliver. And that his word is his promise. His promise will be shown to be true, and he will deliver them, so the whole psalm is consistent. So you see, it's something that we do in our own texts. We have to do the same thing anywhere in the New Testament, interpreting parables, all sorts of stuff like that. So you've got to do that with the Quran as well. This is how human language works. If you want to honor what the original author intended to communicate, and let's be honest, there are Muslims and there are Christians for whom that is not their ultimate goal at all. I would argue, for example, that Roman Catholics are in a weird situation where, especially in certain texts of scripture, they're far more concerned about finding a means of substantiating the traditions of Rome than they are concerned about the original authorial intent of a scriptural text. And I think it's even more the case with Muslims, where it's the final interpretation that has been codified in the traditions that they're looking for, and it's not as much of an issue amongst them. We raise this issue all the time. Not normally something that is a big part of the conversation in the Muslim experience. So when we say, well, you need to look, who's being addressed here? Oh, people of the book. So this is the Al-Kitab. And since it immediately says the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, this would be one of those places, because sometimes Al-Kitab could be Jews, Christians, Jews and Christians. In this instance, obviously, it's Christians. This shows that Al-Injil, as it will in Surah 5, and it would have the same meaning. Do not commit excess in your religion. Now, I have confessed this numerous times, down through the years, but the command here, do not commit excess. As much as I try, I cannot pronounce the combination of a particular Arabic letter and the voweling at that point. There's a r sound, but I can't get my Scottish wattles to work with it. But it is a command to not commit excess. Go beyond the bound. Go beyond the boundaries. To aglu, something like that. What's important is both in the Quran and then in early hadith sources. Hadith are the actions and sayings of Muhammad and his companions collected hundreds of years later. And then there are traditions that are even earlier than the hadith collections that are extremely helpful and give us insights into the early interpretation of the Quran. There's solid evidence that Muhammad, when you go to Surah 1 and it talks about people who've been, lead us not into the way of those who receive your wrath or those who go astray. There's early tradition that Muhammad interpreted that those who receive Allah's wrath are the Jews. Those who have been deceived and go astray are the Christians. So this committing of an excess, that's what this is about. And so it seems, this is my interpretation, I would argue I think it's a fair interpretation. My interpretation is that this is a command. Since it's going to say, do not say three, then the author of the Quran believes it is excess. That what we have done is we have taken someone who is worthy of not religious worship, but of veneration, not in the Roman Catholic sense, of being honored. Muslims would say that they honor Prophet Jesus. And then there's a line, and what we've done has gone beyond it. And what is involved going on it, beyond it, is the exaltation of Jesus to a position where the worship of Jesus detracts from the worship of Allah, and hence, I think, and there are some, I would think somewhat less conservative Muslims in the United States today, but mainly Muslims who know, who've taken some classes and understand what the doctrine of the Trinity actually teaches. There are a lot of Muslims today that know far more about what the doctrine of the Trinity actually teaches than the author of the Quran ever did. That's very clear. So they would avoid saying this, but I think the strongest argument can be made that the author of the Quran identifies the worship of Jesus as shirk. And shirk's an unforgivable sin. Not in the sense of you can't get forgiveness of it in this life, but you can't get forgiveness of it in the next life. If you die as a mushrik, a person who has committed the sin of shirk, if you die in that state, there is no forgiveness for you. The Quran's very clear on that. Yeah, there are some liberal Muslims that are moving away from even that, but the Quran's very clear on that. If you die as a mushrik, there's no forgiveness. Western Muslims are struggling with that. That's, we'll go into that right now. So, do not commit excess in your deen. Deen is your religion, your religious practices. Or say a law except, say about a law except the truth. So, the excess is going online, but also involves saying something about a law that isn't true. Well, what are you saying about a law that isn't true? I would submit that a fair reading of the Quran would be Allah has a son. Again, what the author of the Quran understands that to mean is another issue we have to deal with. I don't think he had an accurate understanding of what sonship meant. It never crossed his mind. Allah has a son, and that there are three divine persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Or is that what the author of the Quran understood? Is there any evidence that he was aware of Father, Son, Holy Spirit and the distinctions between them? Or are there other threes that are mentioned in the Quran that would be more fairly and accurately applied to the author's understanding of who the three are? So here's a command. Do not commit excess. Do not say anything about a law except what is true. The Messiah, Jesus, Son of Mary. Now, I really wasn't intending to go this depth in depth, but the reality is it's been years since we did a lot in the Muslim area, and I apologize for that. And I just say to all of my listeners, ask yourself the question why, when you're presented with an opportunity of learning the basic foundations of the next largest body of people in the world to whom we need to bring the gospel, why is it that so many Christians have no passion for it, don't have the time for it, don't have an interest in it? I've done the work. Okay, let me remind you, I've debated more Muslims formally than Roman Catholics. The majority, the group that I've done the most, not the majority, but the group I've done the most public debates with have been Muslims. And I've done so all around the world. And so someone who has done the work for all that time, and as all that experience says, let me lay it out for you. I just find a lot of Christians are just like, ho-hum. And so I'm not trying to berate anybody there. I'm just telling you what my experience is, in essence. So my encouragement to you would be, keep listening during these segments. Obviously, we cover other topics during the dividing line, but keep listening during these segments and get hold of this app or something similar to it. Get yourself a copy of the Quran and be prepared. I guarantee you, if you start praying, Lord, put a love in my heart for the Muslim people, you'll start having opportunities you never, ever saw coming. And you'll discover that the Muslim people are very different from what you see. Hello. My heart rate just increased 27%. They're very different from what you see and what we will be seeing about the Taliban and things like that. And I just hope that especially the quality people that follow and support this program will be the very people who say, you know what? I need to be prepared. I need to be prepared. I'm going to do that work. So I'll continue with the discussion of the phrase Jesus, the Son of Mary. Was not intending to go this in depth, but it's a useful opportunity to provide some of the foundational stuff we haven't talked about for quite some time. So that's what we'll try to keep doing. I don't know when we're going to get a chance to get together again. I'm speaking up here. By the way, I don't know if this is on the website, on the calendar, but if you are in the area, you have to call. There's limited space for the church. And so if 50 more people show up that they aren't expecting, there's no place for them to go and they don't want anything like that. Good. Rich said he did. So thank you. Then I get back on Friday. I don't know when I get back on Friday, but I sort of doubt I'm going to have time for Dividing Line because, even once my little house gets to my big house, there's a lot of stuff in the little house to move back into the big house. You know what I mean? So we'll see, as far as that is concerned. But once again, let me just say as we wrap up the program today, Lord willing, and I get home in one piece on Friday. Nearly 4,000 miles and a lot of ministry done in Colorado, in Montana, Idaho, and Nevada. Proved we could do it. This is how we're going to do G3. By the way, the G3 schedule has come out, and I have graduated from morning speaker to afternoon speaker. And Friday afternoon, I kick things off. So it's me, followed by Vody, followed by Paul Washer. So that's going to be interesting evening. No two ways about it. I'm looking forward to seeing the venue. I haven't seen it. This is a new venue. So I'm looking forward to that. But this, what I'm sitting in right now, is what I'll be sitting in Friday morning as I'm getting ready to head out and get down to the venue and meet folks and do stuff like that. And primarily, the people who watch this program is why I have this unit here, why I have the truck up front, why I've been getting the Alpha and Omega card out at every gas station. Would have been a lot cheaper to have done this last year when gas was half of what it costs now. But that's how we do it. Is you've been supporting us. You support us with the travel fund. You support us with the ministry resource list. You support us with general giving to the ministry. We don't talk a lot about that, but I just want you to know there isn't some ultra-rich person that just dropped this on us. This is budgetary stuff. And so if you think it's cool that after driving for 8.5 hours, I still had the energy left to talk about in-depth stuff in the phone, then you want to keep that happening, you know how to do it. We appreciate it. We thank you very much for it. We especially appreciate the churches that support us and things like that. So, anyways, I'm not sure, like I said, when we'll get back together again, but hope, well, and I think I've got to deliver this thing to a for some warranty work. You normally need something like that done after your first shakedown. You know, there's a couple doors that need a little tightening and things like that, which is what you expect. But I think that's on Monday, so I have to do that too. So we'll let you know. It'll be on the app, and we will press on. And something tells me there will probably be even further examples of the fact that Romans 1 is true and being lived out in front of us throughout the United States by the time Monday rolls around. But between now and then, I'm really looking forward to being back at Apologia on Sunday. And everybody, it's been quite some time, and I hope that you will have a sweet fellowship at your church as well. With that, thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. God bless.